From Uniontown to Huntington, Warren to York, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, a major trucking company closes and the state budget standoff enters its second month. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And it has been around longer than the automobile itself. We still need AM radio. I'll explain why on this week's Town Hall Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Nominees have been chosen for a special election to fill a vacant Allegheny County seat in the State House of Representatives. The seat is vacant due to the resignation of Sarah Inamorato, who is running in this November's election as the Democratic nominee for Allegheny County Executive. The special election will be held September 19th with Aaron Connolly Ottenreith as the Republican nominee and Lindsey Powell the Democrat nominee. The district leans heavily Democrat, but until the seat is filled, the state house is tied with 101 Republican and 101 Democrat members. Governor Josh Shapiro has negotiated new contracts with two state government labor unions, this behind closed doors with no transparency related to the talks. The outcome is some state employees could see pay raises of more than 20% over the next 4 years. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, and the Service Employees International Union have reached agreements which give their members the biggest pay hikes in over 20 years. Both unions were heavy contributors to Shapiro's gubernatorial election campaign. Broad and Liberty reports that the executive director of the State House Democrat Campaign Committee has collected over $365,000 in so-called reimbursements over the past 3 years. The committee works to elect Democrats to the state house and is subject to campaign finance disclosure laws. Such large reimbursements are highly unusual and have raised a red flag over their nature. The committee did not respond to Broad and Liberty's request for comment. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Trucking giant Yellow Freight is going out of business. For a look at the factors behind the demise of the logistics company, we turn to our Capital Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars from Pennsylvania's foremost free market think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, Vice President Steve Bloom. Steve, great to see you.
Great to see you, David, and great to be here.
And another all-star member of our team, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, great to see you too.
Great to be back again, Dave. Thank you.
So, you know, again, we're on the scene here in Sin City, Harrisburg, PA, trying to figure out what's going on. But since we have our leading lady of logistics here in the studio, we wanted to ask first of all about the big news from the world of trucking. Rebecca, what's going on with Yellow?
Yellow, yes. It's a sad story we have in trucking, and we just this past weekend saw the demise of the Yellow Corporation, a 99-year-old trucking company that's been through the ups and downs of the U.S. economy through all of the last century. The third largest less than truckload carrier in the country, and actually they were the first less than truckload carrier to open in the U.S.
Now, what does that mean, less than truckload?
Less than truckload is anything bigger than a parcel and smaller than a truckload. So your pallet size deliveries that go out to manufacturers and small businesses and those types of organizations that that require trucking and transportation, those are less than truckload.
Okay, so that, but folks, that's what we mean when Rebecca says less than load or LTL.
LTL, that's right. Yep. So they were the third largest LTL carrier in the nation. And so losing them is a hit. I mean, it's obviously going to have an impact on the supply chain. I think we're going to see some repercussions throughout the economy for a little while here. They had 30,000 employees in all 50 states. Mm. So quite a hit to employment in the industry as well. So they also, and I want to say too that it's been a great company. Their employees are well known for their being tremendous advocates for the trucking industry. They were a member of ours
yes.
here in the state, also a member of the American Trucking Associations, very involved, tremendous advocates for highway safety, which is very helpful to everyone here in the industry. And they actually have 22 drivers that are going to the National Truck Driving Championships in a couple weeks. One from Pennsylvania. So we're happy those drivers are still going to be able to participate in the championship.
Yeah,
so.
Of course. But how did this great giant of your industry fall?
Well, I think it was a combination of complicated factors. They were recently trying to sort of reset their financial condition by reorganizing the business a little bit and ran into some issues and were unable ultimately to reach an agreement with the union on that reorganization.
Teamsters.
Yes. On the reorganization of the business, and ultimately just couldn't pay the bills, I think, from what I understand.
So what kind of signal does this, give the rest of the economy about the state of your industry?
Well, I think it's hard to draw any conclusions from the demise of Yellow broadly across the industry, because I think it was a special case. It had its own circumstances. So it's hard to draw conclusions about this specific instance. But I do think there are conclusions to be had more broadly about the impact of when a company like this goes out of business. In a broader sense, I think we can talk about how complex and critical the supply chain is to the nation's economy. And so when you have something like this happen, there's repercussions that go throughout the economy and throughout manufacturing and throughout, consumer goods, delivery of consumer goods. And as I've talked before about how, everything that we buy or consume is on a truck at some point,
mm-hmm.
sometimes at multiple times
right.
along the supply chain. So many times along the supply chain. So every time a good touches a truck, it is part of that supply chain that we all talk about. So when you have an impact to the supply chain, it really does affect all of the products that you and I use all the time, all the goods that are transported across the nation, all the raw materials that manufacturers use to produce those goods.
Of course.
We want to be very careful about how we might impact the supply chain moving forward. So because of its criticality to the economy. And this is a good example of what happens when something happens to a big company in the industry.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we try not to cause those big impacts where we can. We don't want to do things that cause this to happen.
Yes.
And there are a lot of regulations that are under discussion right now at the state and, especially in the federal level, that are going to put a really, really unreasonable demands on the industry, especially in the area of emissions requirements.
Right. And this is the adoption nationwide of the California standards.
Yes. A push way before we're ready to move to electric vehicles, and especially electric trucks, obviously, in this case,
yeah.
Which really have not been tested broadly in the industry. There are so many complicating factors. Using electric trucks to haul heavy goods and to haul supplies that we're talking about here, that we really have to be careful how we're managing these mandates, because we're going to end up putting folks out of business, because electric trucks cost 3 to 4 times more than diesel trucks.
Well, and there's also the question of performance. Can these electric trucks do the work that we have come to depend upon our 18-wheelers for?
The answer is no, not yet. They can't. Generally in the industry, there are some aspects of the industry where electric trucks work well. So where you have a central terminal, for example, where delivery trucks every day go out and make deliveries and come back and can charge overnight. That's a good example of where an electric truck might work very well because they're not traveling long distances. They're not generally carrying very heavy loads and they can charge regularly. But especially for big trucks that travel across, you know, across the nation, it's impractical at this point. And mostly because of charging. There isn't enough charging infrastructure that's deployed, and it's not planned to be deployed.
And as you've said before, there aren't even enough parking spots.
Exactly, right. And I mean, we talk all the time about trucks pulled alongside the highways. You know, on and off ramps. And that's not a good situation. We don't want to see that. We need more truck parking spots so that doesn't have to happen. But let's just say there's no chargers along the highways like that. So basically, because of the charging requirements and the fact that you have to stop to charge every, you know, 300, 400 miles at least, it would take at least two trucks to fill the role of every one. And perhaps more than that. We already have a lack of drivers, too, in the industry. So imagine trying to find drivers for twice as many trucks. So it would cause so many problems that we have to make sure that we're being very, very careful about how we're moving forward with new technologies like this. The market will find the best solution. There's no doubt about it. I mean, no one wants no one wants dirty air. And the very fact of the matter is, and what's so frustrating to me, is that trucks today are 60 times cleaner than trucks produced in 1988. The fact of the matter is that one truck in 1988 is the equivalent emissions of 60 trucks today.
That's amazing
It's amazing. If we could just replace older trucks, pre-2010 trucks that are on the road, 2010 is when new emission standards went into effect and were required. After that point, we have near zero emissions in trucks. If we could just replace the older trucks on the road or incentivize replacement of those with new cleaner technologies, whether that be diesel, electric, natural gas, someday hydrogen, you know, just let the market determine what the best solution is.
No, we can't do that, Rebecca. It would make too much sense. Well, you're listening to Capital Watch. This is David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. So for those of us who are involved with the public policy arena in Harrisburg, that the ongoing budget drama continues. And Steve, you want to give us an update on what you've been seeing and hearing?
Sure, David. We are approaching about 40 days now of budget impasse. And what that means is there are payments that were supposed to start being distributed by the state, by the treasurer's office, in accordance with state law, in July that did not go out. And we're here now in mid-August, and the threat of things getting much worse. If it drags on through August and into September and October, that's when you see school districts, you see county services, you see organizations that are depending on particular programs really start to suffer and have to figure out where are we going to get the money to stay open? How are we going to do that? And so that's the high level drama that's starting to unfold is people are starting to see that they're not getting what they thought they were going to get from the state government, which is, you know, the whole budget is $44 billion plus. So it's a lot of money. It's a lot of taxpayer funds that get dispersed. On a more micro level, what has happened is, and this has been now the case for several weeks, the House and Senate both did pass a general appropriations bill. That's the list of what we're going to spend money on and how much.
Right.
It is held by the Senate. The Senate's going to be coming back very soon in order to let that bill be signed by the presiding officer, which then triggers the procedural process of the bill being delivered to the governor for his decision as to whether he wishes to veto the bill, sign the bill, partially veto on a budget bill. The governor has what's called a blue line veto. He can pick literally individual items out to veto, or he could even do nothing and let it lapse into law after 10 days without a signature. He has a lot of options. He has said publicly, though, that he's planning to veto the Lifeline Scholarship Program, which is a $100 million program in a $44 plus billion budget that would provide for opportunities for children who, for kids who attend the lowest performing 15% of schools to get access to a scholarship that they could use to help them find an alternative, a private school, a non-public school alternative that would excel and allow that child to finally achieve his or her potential rather than languish in a neighborhood zip code assigned school that has chronically been failing where proficiency levels are in some of these schools zero in math and reading.
The infuriating thing is that Governor Shapiro on the campaign trail said that he was for this and that this is the budget deal that he helped to negotiate.
And this is there are kind of like almost like three acts playing out here. The first phase of it, Act One, was Governor Shapiro talking very positively about the need for more school choice, Lifeline scholarships in particular, working with Senate leadership to negotiate a budget built around that idea, in which the Senate indicated that Lifeline scholarships were its number one priority.
Yes.
In which the governor went on national TV and said that it was a priority for him and he would support it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the 11th hour, as the deadline approached, he announced that he was planning to veto the very thing he was for.
Well, and
that was Act One.
Yes, yes. And just again to provide a little bit of color commentary here, you take that plan to the House, which is just barely controlled by the Democrats, and the Democrat majority leader says, that our union masters will never allow us to sign off on these Lifeline scholarships, and therefore we can't pass this budget. So instead of at that point, you go, okay, that's the top priority for the chamber. We've got to start over. You know, instead of doing that the governor, I guess, is the one who came up with the idea of saying, I will take this particular thing, use my, you know, I'll use the blade and cut that one thing out. And then expect the Senate to just like roll over and say, oh, that's okay. You can play us for chumps. We don't mind.
When that one thing was literally and said many times by all members of Senate leadership, literally the Senate's number one priority.
Yes. Yes.
It wasn't some side thing, some small attachment. It was the thing that they talked about consistently from January through July.
And the
July.
Thing for which they made concessions.
And bipartisan issue, too.
Exactly.
And which is not to be lost.
In the Senate, at least one Democrat voted for it. In the Senate, we know there is support amongst the House Democrats for it. Many of them are afraid to come out and say that, but we have absolute solid indication that there are a number of Democrats in the state House, which is divided, and it's a 101 to 101 standoff between Republicans and Democrats. Many of those Democrats would vote for Lifeline if presented with the bill or a budget with Lifeline in it. So
Act two begins,
and we're watching this long struggle play out. What is likely to happen is the governor will do whatever he does with the budget bill, and then attention will turn to the fiscal code bills that actually implement the funding that's listed in the general appropriations bill.
Mm-hmm.
Without fiscal code instructions, the new money cannot be distributed. There was not only money in the original bill for Lifeline scholarships, but also the Democrats in exchange had extracted concessions around increased educational spending, special programs, home rebuildings, stipends for teachers, universal free breakfast for kids, all sorts of public school kids, all sorts of quote unquote goodies that the Democrats had asked for and got from the Senate in exchange for Lifeline scholarships. All that's now tied up.
Mm-hmm.
None of that can happen without a fiscal code to guide the overall direction that was spelled out in the budget bill itself. So we're going to see now playing out the drama of renegotiating essentially the fiscal code bills in such a way to preserve Lifeline and preserve potentially some of the trade-offs for it. But if that doesn't happen, if that sort of a compromise can't be reached, then we're probably looking at a stripped down bare bones budget that cuts out all those goodies and also unfortunately cuts out the Lifeline scholarship program. So the pressure is on right now to get a budget done. The governor and Senate are negotiating again. We've heard that from numerous sources that they're talking. So we're expecting some action here over the next couple of weeks. But the third act of this strange play is that meanwhile, the state House, being at a 101-101 deadlock, is supposedly not coming back to session until September 26th.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's going to cause several more months of pain and frustrating suffering from people who are relying on the expected transfer
state
of money
support,
from the state.
Yeah.
So that's going to start to cause a lot of trouble. And if they, in fact, refuse to come back because they're afraid they might not be able to the Democrats who were in charge of the Senate are afraid they might not be able to get their way with a 101-101 split, because if they lose a few Democrats, which we know a few Democrats support school choice, they're going to be in trouble. So the next stage of this is, will the Democrats come back? Will they resolve this, or are they going to try to hold off until late September or October,
right,
just to protect what they think will be a majority by then?
Right, because there's a special election coming up for the representative who resigned to go be the Democrat nominee for Allegheny County Executive. So,
correct.
Yeah, and again, this is one of those rhetorical questions. Does it seem like it really shouldn't be this hard?
It shouldn't be. The parties had the principles in this negotiation, the governor and the Senate leadership. They had a handshake deal. They talked about it. They agreed upon it. They each made adjustments and compromises around it. Anyone who's worked in the political arena or the business arena knows that when you have a handshake deal, it's a serious problem to then walk away from that.
Yeah.
And basically say, oh, sorry, we got what we wanted. Now you don't get the thing you agreed that would be given in exchange.
Yeah.
That's not how anyone plays in business, in politics, and it really burns the people who do that kind of thing. It demeans the negotiating authority of the governor that he allowed this to happen and that he has been a part of it.
That's what I was going to ask. What do you think the impact will be moving forward because of that?
It's going to cause a lot of bitterness now over the remaining 3.5 years of the governor's term.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
And he was off to such a good start, too, and the tone that he struck. It's really kind of shocking to see all that go away and just evaporate. But anyway, that's where we are right now. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for our show. But anyway, let's go around the horn. Steve, where can the listeners find out more about you and what you do?
They can visit CommonwealthFoundation.org.
Outstanding. Rebecca, where do people go to find out more about you?
The Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association is at pmta.org. We also, I want to mention, have a link there to a new database that's specifically set up to help former Yellow employees find employment in the industry.
Excellent. Thanks so much for that. And as always, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. From Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. How we listen to music, news, and other content as we drive on our daily commute or travel around the country has changed dramatically over the years. We have installed everything on our dashboards from 8-track tape players to CBs to CD players to satellite radio to smartphone inputs. Each new technology improved on and sometimes replaced the previous. But one platform has been there from the very beginning, survived every change in listening habits, and continues to have relevance: AM, or amplitude modulation radio. As each new technological fad unfolded, trusty old AM radio held on to its spot on our dash. Its obituary has been written many times. The advent of FM radio with its crystal clear signal, capable of broadcasting music in stereo, would surely render AM radio obsolete. Rush Limbaugh and the rise of News Talk Radio saved the day. Now, once again, AM radio is being threatened with extinction. The culprit? The rising popularity of electric vehicles. Electric vehicles generate electromagnetic interference that causes static in some AM radio signals. Rather than install a relatively inexpensive workaround, some manufacturers of electric vehicles are opting to not place AM radio in their product. According to the media tracking firm Nielsen, 92% of the U.S. population tunes into terrestrial radio, both AM and FM, more than any other medium. The National Association of Broadcasters points out that nearly 50 million Americans still tune into AM radio. In many rural parts of the nation, AM is one of the few, if not the only, option available to listeners. As mentioned, AM radio continues to be a widely listened-to platform for news and information. During times of emergency or natural disaster, when cell phone and internet services are interrupted, the wide range of the AM signal often provides the only dependable source of information. That is why 7 former Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, administrators have voiced their concerns over the lack of AM radios in EVs. FEMA's National Integrated Public Alert and Warning System delivers safety alerts through broadcast AM stations. As with every issue these days, there is a political ideological component to the AM radio controversy. AM radio is the home base for conservative talk radio. Rush Limbaugh is no longer with us, but his legacy is the many nationally syndicated and locally popular talk shows that populate AM programming. The left has never been able to get a talk radio foothold, so eliminating the AM platform for them is the next best thing. But AM radio is not yet ready to roll over and play dead, and its continued relevance in broadcasting emergency information may be AM radio's salvation. Concerned that the demise of AM radio would impede the dissemination of emergency information, a bipartisan group of federal lawmakers, spearheaded by Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, have proposed the AM for Every Vehicle Act. The act would give the U.S. Secretary of Transportation 1 year to establish a standard for all new motor vehicles in the U.S. to include AM reception and playback. The bill would require the AM dial to be clearly visible on each vehicle's dashboard. Until the new standard takes effect, vehicles lacking AM reception must be clearly labeled as such for consumers. Cruz termed AM radio, quote, a critical bulwark for democracy, and Markey argued that AM radio should continue to be placed in vehicles and also not placed behind a costly paywall. The senators are walking their bill through the legislative process. Just last week, the legislation passed out of the Senate Commerce Committee. And while the legislative process chugs forward, consumer pressure is having an impact. Ford changed direction and announced that it will include AM radio in its 2024 vehicles. The automaker is also providing a software update in its two EV models that were released without AM radio. Ford CEO Jim Farley cited the band's critical role in the emergency alert system as the reason for the change in direction. And so, as I sit here, looking at the stack of CDs I can no longer listen to in my Explorer, because Ford stopped putting CD players in their vehicles, I can at least take solace in that I can still listen to my favorite morning show hosts on my dependable AM radio. It's a good thing that some things in life don't change. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCCS-AM and WLCY-AM in Indiana, WJSA-FM in Jersey Shore, along with WNTP-AM and WFIL-AM in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.